is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hi, this is Don Showalter from USA Basketball, and you are listening to the Hoop Heads Podcast.
Hey, Hoop Heads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. We've had their partnership manager and training specialist, Jefferson Mason, and their marketing manager, Nick Bartlett, on the show in the past, and we couldn't be more excited about what they're doing for the game of basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Beyond efficient reps, Dr. Dish provides training expertise and versatility designed to develop complete players. The new Dr. Dish CT machine has further revolutionized basketball training with over 150-plus on-demand individual and team workouts from some of the best coaches and trainers in the game. These workouts include video instruction and combine game-like shooting drills with ball handling, conditioning, and agility drills. Along with workouts, the Dr. Dish training management system also provides stat tracking and analytics to track progress and ensure accountability. These are just a few reasons why top programs like Duke, North Carolina, Louisville, Florida, Baylor, and countless others are upgrading to Dr. Dish. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoop Heads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoop Heads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Winning games is fun, that's for sure. But the long-lasting things that for me are the relationships that I have and will continue to have with our players. They're lifelong friends. They mean so much to you. Establish those relationships by really getting to know your guys and really work hard at trying to make an impression and influence on them off the court as well as on the court. Pay attention to their academics, pay attention to their lives in general, and really try to influence them as people as well as players.
Coach Steve Moore retired at the end of the 2019-2020 basketball season, after amassing a 38-year career record of 846 and 245, including an extraordinary mark of 759 and 180 the past 32 seasons at the College of Worcester in the state of Ohio. That mark puts him number two in wins among Division III coaches all time. The winningest coach at Worcester's tradition-rich program, Moore directed the Fighting Scots to 27 NCAA tournament berths and a league-high 18 North Coast Athletic Conference championships while compiling a winning percentage of .808. Moore has been named the NCAC Coach of the Year 9 times and the NABC District Coach of the Year for the Great Lakes 5 times. Also, following the 2002-2003 season, he was voted the Ohio College Basketball Coach of the Year, and in April of 2008, the NABC presented him a prestigious Guardian of the Game Award for Education, an honor also once bestowed on the legendary John Wooden. Steve owns a career-winning percentage of .775, ranking him number two in that category all-time in Division III. After you listen to our conversation with Steve Moore, jump over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a 5-star rating and review. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe right now and visit our website, hoopheadspod.com, to find every episode we've ever recorded. Let your friends and colleagues in the game know about the show so they can gain insights from some of the best minds in the game, from the grassroots to the NBA. If you haven't grabbed your notebook, go get it now so you don't miss anything as you listen to our conversation with Steve Moore from the College of Worcester in the state of Ohio.
Hello and welcome to the Hoop Heads Podcast. It's Mike Linsing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight, we are honored to be joined on the podcast by longtime College of Worcester Fighting Scott head coach Steve Moore. Steve, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Mike. Good to be with you guys.
We are very excited to be able to have someone as accomplished as you are in the coaching profession with us tonight. And we wanted to dig into your entire basketball journey and go back to the very start when you were a young kid and just talk to us a little bit about how you got into the game of basketball when you were a child.
Okay, well, Lots of years ago, of course. I certainly remember playing in what we called peewee basketball. I think I was in the fourth grade, and there were a couple of gentlemen in the community. I don't think they had sons at that time, our age, but they thought that having a youth basketball program was so important. So in Monroeville, Ohio, real small town near Norwalk and Sandusky, that was my hometown, Monroeville, Ohio. And these two gentlemen started a Saturday morning league for fourth, fifth, and sixth graders. And we basically just played games, but we got indoctrinated into the game, and it was a lot of fun, and just made me want to keep playing the game.
And so when you got that taste of, quote, organized basketball, then did you find yourself playing out on your driveway with your friends in the neighborhood, or did you just stick with that program, or were you playing everywhere and anything? I'm sure you were playing multiple sports when you were a kid out in the sort of the sand lot.
Yes, that was it. Back in the days, we had, you know, we weren't in the gyms that much, so sand lot baseball and football. But yeah, I had a basket in the driveway up against our barn that we had, and I would go out there and shoot all the time. Even remember shooting when it was snowing, and shoveled the snow so I could, you know, have a court to shoot on. And yeah, those are some good memories. A lot of outside basketball in those days.
Was basketball your number one thing right from the beginning, or were other sports sort of its equal until you got a little bit older?
I would say basketball and baseball. We had a good little league baseball system in our town, and we played a lot of baseball. So probably up until junior high, baseball was right there. But I think starting in junior high, basketball started being the favorite.
Once you started focusing in on basketball, do you remember what you did to improve yourself as a player? What were some of the things that did you go and find games in other communities? Did you just work by yourself? Just explain a little bit of your process about how you tried to get better and improve as a player.
Well, in high school, it was a lot on my own. Once again, outdoors, because in the summers, we didn't have open gyms. You know, in those days, back in the 60s, late 60s and 70, they didn't have, the coaches didn't open the gyms. You just played out on the playground. And so I would play out on the courts outside the high school a lot with guys from our town, high school, but also would go to Norwalk some. That was a bigger town about 5 miles away. And I remember going over there and playing on the outdoor courts in Norwalk. So, yeah, in high school, I did those things. And then once I got into college, of course, in the summer times, I was working road construction. And one summer I was in Warren, Ohio, and had to scout around, find guys to play with. And then the last couple of years when I was working road construction, it was closer to home in Sandusky. And so I would drive from actually the job I was working on was in Vermilion, which is right down the road from Sandusky. So I would drive from a job be finished work in Vermilion. I would drive over to Sandusky and play on the playground there. There was a guy named Scott May, who was a couple years younger than me, but he was back home from Indiana playing on the court. So guys like that, I got to play against in the summer.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think kids today miss out on is that playground culture. We've talked about it with a lot of coaches who are my age, 50 and older, that just remember those playground basketball days and just how people would congregate, and you'd have certain days and certain courts where some of the best players, whether it was guys home from college or just really good players, would congregate. And it's something that today, I still think that's one of the, I don't know, saddest was the way to say it, but just I'm always disappointed that the playground culture of basketball is gone. And obviously there's some benefits to kids moving indoors into gyms, and I think there's better coaching that kids are exposed to earlier, but I think they missed out on something with that playground pickup basketball that you and I sort of grew up with.
I agree, Mike. Those were a lot of fun. Those were fun days. You know, sometimes you get 40, 50 guys there and on one court, and you'd have to wait your turn. And when you got on the court, you played hard, because if you lost, you'd get out, you were off the court. And it made you really work hard. It was a competitive thing, and it was a lot of fun, too.
Yeah, I agree. Some of my best memories of basketball are just not so much with the organized teams that I played on all through my youth and then on up through high school and college, but I just think about my time on the playground, the friends that I made, and just those memories are really, really special to me. When you think about your high school career, at what point did you start to consider or think or desire to play college basketball? At what point did that start to come onto your radar?
Well, I do remember specifically when I was in high school, back in those days, you didn't see as many college games on TV. And today there's just a game on all the time. But back in the late 60s and 1970, I graduated from high school in 1970, there weren't that many games on TV. But our high school coach, Jerry Everhart, took us, my junior year, we went up to Bowling Green. He took us to a game there, and Bowling Green was playing Finley. And I just got so excited about basketball that game, watching that game live at Bowling Green State University. I just saw such intensity and hard work, which I'd never seen before. And I think that turned me on to basketball more than anything and made me think, boy, I'd sure love to play college basketball. And then the next year, my senior year, the coach took us to Ashland University. Bill Musselman was the coach there. And boy, I was amazed at the talent level there. And in fact, they were playing Wittenberg, where I ended up playing. I had no idea I would end up playing there, but I watched those games, and that just inspired me to watch those college games in person. And I think that's when I decided I really would like to play in college.
Yeah, I think that's something that is another thing that is sort of lost in today's world, especially with kids and the amount of distractions that they have in terms of computers and phones and all these different things. I'm not sure that if you compare, I just know the number of games that I went to when I was a kid, whether it's college games, or my dad was a professor at Cleveland State, so I went to a lot of Cleveland State games simply because he was down at work, and then my mom and my sister would drive down after work and go and see a Cleveland State game. And I went to tons of high school games at in my hometown here in Strongsville. And I think that that's something that what you mentioned is when you watch that, is then it made you want to aspire to be able to do those same things that you were watching. And that was something that meant a lot to me too. I would go to Strongsville games when I was fourth or fifth grade, and I'd want to be a part of that program. And then I would see college basketball. I'm like, man, that's what I want to do. I want to be able to do that. And I think sometimes that's missing in today's kids, because it's more like college is an idea as opposed to they've really seen a lot of games. I know we've talked to some other Division III coaches. I'm probably sure you could speak to this too, is when you're recruiting kids, we've had other coaches say that, you know, they'll be sitting in the room with a recruit and his parents and say, well, you know, the kid's kind of like, well, I'm not sure I want to go Division III. I think I'm better than that level. And the coach will say, well, have you ever been to a Division III game? Have you ever seen the level of skill that it takes to play at this level? And I think a lot of times kids just aren't seeing those games. Have you found that when you were recruiting kids, that kids you were talking to have never even seen a Division III game?
Most definitely, Mike. I think so many people out there don't really realize how good of players there are in small college basketball, Division II and Division III. They see, you know, the kids and even parents and just the general fans watch the major college games on TV, and they don't realize how good their small college players are. And you know, guys think, well, my high school has more students than Worcester has, so therefore I could easily play there. I would be really good there. And they just have no idea.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest pieces of information that is missing in the education of players and parents. And I think with the AAU culture, and just I think people get told all the time, whether it's parents, families, kids, they get told how good they are and what level they can play at, and not necessarily by somebody who has their best interest at heart. And then they end up finding out when they go and they get an opportunity to see what Division III basketball looks like, or what NAIA basketball looks like, or Division II basketball looks like. And they're stunned by the level of play. And I think for anybody who hasn't gone out and gotten an opportunity to see that, especially if you're a middle school parent of a middle school player, get your kid out to see a Division III game. If you're a high school player and Those are some of the schools that are recruiting you. You want to go out and see those games and watch the high level of play that is prevalent everywhere in Division III basketball. And I think it's just something that we've tried to do that here on the podcast by talking to lots of different Division III coaches just to get the word out about the quality of, as you said, small college basketball and how good those players really are. I don't think people have any idea.
Very true, Mike. And, you know, what people don't realize is some of the guys that we get in our Division III level, maybe they aren't going to be able to play Division I major college basketball right away. But by the time they're juniors, seniors, they've worked and improved. We have guys that could play Division I at that time. So, and that's why we've had a lot of success at Worcester, because we've had guys who have improved and gotten that good. And so, but yeah, you're right. People don't realize it, but I think a lot of high school coaches do.
Yeah, and I think that's probably something that's improved, I would guess, over the years, is that have you found that high school coaches today are more aware of the recruiting process maybe than they were, let's say, 25, 30 years ago?
Yes, I think that's true, Mike. And just because I think recruiting has become such a big deal, not just at major college, but in small college, Division III, a lot of people say, well, you don't have scholarships, how do you recruit? Well, you have to recruit harder. And when I first started coaching in Division III, back when I was assistant coach at Wittenberg in the 70s, not that many coaches worked real hard at it. I know I was coaching with Larry Hunter back then, went on to coach at Howe University, as you know, and did a great job, was an awesome coach, and I learned so much from him. And we worked really hard at it, but nowadays, everybody's working at it, every Division III coach. It's just filtered down. A lot of guys, you know, were in Division I or they got exposure to that recruiting. And when we go to a high school game in Northeastern Ohio, in the Cleveland area, Akron, Canton, we're there, but so are about 10 other coaches.
Right, right.
Yeah, so it's very, very competitive. And so, therefore, you know, the high school coaches, you know, they're talked to by a lot of Division III coaches, NAIA coaches, like you say. So they understand and they get it, and they're really important to us in educating the high school boys.
Yeah, I'm sure that for you, having been at Worcester for as long as you were, that just building those relationships with high school coaches and getting to the point where they trust you and you trust them to give you an honest evaluation of a player, whether or not that player can A, play at your level, and then B, what kind of kid they are. Let's stay with that recruiting. I know we're moving a little bit forward, but I think this is an interesting line of thinking for some of our audience. When you're talking to a high school coach, how much of what you're talking to them about is the character and sort of the intangibles of the player versus the actual basketball skill? Obviously, there's a certain skill level that they have to have, and I'm sure that by the time you get an opportunity to see them, you've already sort of made an evaluation to some degree about their basketball skill. At least they have some potential to be able to play at your level. So how much conversation goes on between you and their high school coach about those intangibles, those off the court things, those personality characteristics?
That's really a very important point, Mike. You're right. You know, we'll see a guy play, and so we know what his skill level is, but we would like to know how he does every day in practice. How what kind of a teammate is he? Is he a team man? What are his work habits like day in and day out? Because as you know, those are the guys that get better once they're in college. The guys with great work habits and great attitudes. So yeah, we ask the coaches of those things, and you really, you know, you rely on a lot of the coaches that you know really well. You know, guys that we've known over the years, because, you know, they really know, we know them and they know us and they know what we're looking for. But you know, you try to meet as many coaches as you can, get to know them. You know, I've been very blessed at Worcester for so many years. Coach Doug Klein, who a lot of our listeners know who I'm talking about, has now assumed the head coaching job at the College of Worcester with my retirement. Coach Klein has been with me. He graduated in 1995, was a great player for us, but he's been coaching with me ever since, and that's unheard of, to have that kind of continuity. And as he got over the years, he just got to know more and more coaches, and he built a tremendous relationship with the coaches in Ohio And so he's been a huge part of the huge reason and a big part of our success in recruiting, the relationships that he's established with high school coaches.
Yeah, I think those relationships have got to be really, really important, just again, in terms of your ability to get honest information about the kids that you're talking to, whether that's players, I'm sure, on their team. And I'm sure you go to a coach sometimes who maybe plays against the player that you're recruiting just to try to get information about that player. Maybe it's not even their own player on their team, but just somebody that they've played against, or maybe somebody in their league. And I'm sure you go to those people for information as well. And I'm sure that with that, as you said, with Coach Klein and the continuity that you're going to have there and him taking over, obviously he has big shoes to fill, but he certainly has had enough experience to understand what's coming next. So let's move backwards though, and go back to the time when you finished up your playing career. And was coaching something that was always on your radar, sort of from the time you were a high school, college player? Or was it a case where you got done playing and you looked around and said, boy, I got to figure out a way to stay involved in the game of basketball? Which one of those paths more accurately describes sort of your journey to coaching?
Well, as a first-year college student, I thought that maybe I would want to be a teacher and a coach. I wasn't sure. But that was a possibility. And I started out majoring in math and thought, well, I'm a math major. I can maybe teach math or do a lot of different things with math. But after a while, I did a pretty good job in the first semester of calculus. I went along, got harder and harder. I ended up being a math minor and a physical education major. And at that point, I said, well, I definitely want to be a coach. So a physical education major was a good thing. But the minor was good, too, because I could get certified to teach in that area, which you can get jobs better in that area. But as my college career went along, and I got influenced more and more by my high school coach, Bob Hamilton, who was the head coach at Wittenberg at that time, I just got very inspired to go into coaching. Obviously, so many people that go into coaching do it for the love of the game, and that was a huge reason for me. I loved the game of basketball. I wanted to stay involved with it. I knew I was not going to be a pro player, so I wouldn't be playing after college. So I thought, well, the best way to do it would be to go into coaching. So that was probably the first reason. And then the second reason, as I mentioned, my college coach, Bob Hamilton, had such a big influence on me, and I thought, well, maybe I can have that same kind of influence or try to do it anyway on players that I would coach. And so those two reasons, I think, are why I went into coaching. And I wasn't sure what level at first. So the first year out, I taught high school and taught that mathematics that I minored in at Springfield Catholic Central. Coached JV basketball, but I decided at that time, well, I'd really like to try college coaching, so I went to Howe University the next year, the second year out of college, and I was very fortunate to be involved with the basketball program there. At that time, Ohio University didn't have a graduate assistant in basketball as such, but I was able to get a teaching assistantship in physical education. Because of Larry Hunter, who I mentioned already. Coach Hunter became the assistant coach at Wittenberg my senior year when I was playing, and he was able to get me involved with the Ohio University Bobcats basketball. Dale Bandy was the head coach, and Larry had played at Ohio University, and so I was able to somewhat volunteer and be their graduate assistant while I got my master's in physical education. So that was my second year out of college, and it was a great experience. Mike Wren was the assistant coach there, and Dale Bandy was the head coach, and Bill Brown, who later on became a Division I assistant and Division I head coach and coached at Cal of Pennsylvania, was the assistant coach. And those guys, it was a great situation for me. I learned a lot of basketball there, and I was very fortunate to get my master's at Ohio University.
All right, two questions. One, what do you remember from that first JV year? And then I want to ask you a question about what some of the things were that you did when you were a graduate assistant. But let's first go with, what was it like when you first stepped in front of your first JV team? What was that experience like? What do you remember from that very first year?
I just remember that going into the job, I thought that I knew everything.
I know that feeling. I felt the exact same way my first job.
Yeah. You know, I played in college and I thought, well, I know how to coach. Well, I found out right away I didn't. We had some nice young men and we worked hard and they were good skilled players, but I wasn't a very good coach, and we went against some teams that had some good players and good coaches, and I learned a lot. I learned that I didn't know very much about coaching, and so that was a great educational experience. But it was a great school to be at. Some fine people. Russ Gunther was the head coach there. Mike Ullman was assistant coach. Mike today is still a good friend of mine. But it was a good year. I was around good people, great people. But I realized that I really didn't want to teach mathematics for 30 years. I had taught, I think, 5 or 6 sections of Algebra 1 in a day. And at the end of the day, I thought, my head was spinning. And I thought, man, did I say that in this class or did I say that
right,
in the other?
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, I admire teachers who teach for 30 years with these in high school, junior high, elementary. But I just wasn't able to do it, I didn't think, for all those years. So I decided, well, I'm going to go back and get my master's and see if I can get into college coaching. And so I was very fortunate to land at Ohio U. And then I know you want to probably ask me about that year at Ohio U, but
what were some of the things you did during that? What was your role? Do you remember what some of the assignments, some of the tasks that you had during that year?
Yeah. What was really interesting, here's a good story. They had a JV team of walk-ons at that time. And I think part of the reason was to see, well, maybe they could pick up a couple of guys that would eventually be varsity players for them. But a lot of it, too, was Bill Brown, who's a great player for Ohio U there. He was of my age, so he was like his second year out of college. And I think Coach Bandy wanted him to get some coaching experience. I don't know if you talked to Coach Brown, if he would say if this is true or not, but that was my memory. And so he was a JV coach, and I helped him out. I came in as a volunteer and kind of, and they said, well, you can help Bill out with the JV guys. And so first game of the JV season, we played Marietta College, who had a bunch of recruited players. You know, their freshmen were recruited, good high school players, whereas, you know, a lot of the OU guys were walk-ons, and good players in their own right, but, you know, we didn't really realize that Marietta would be had that good of JV players, and they kicked their butts, and Coach Manning said, hey, we got to get some players. Bill, you're going on the road. Steve, you take over the JV team. And so I coached the JV team, and it was a good experience. You know, some nice young men, and I think one or two of them ended up actually, I don't know if they got scholarships, but they stayed with the varsity team then for the rest of their career. So that was a good experience there. And just being on the bench with Coach Bandy and Coach Ren and Coach Brown and just being around the program was a great learning experience. And I really am fortunate that I was able to be with those guys.
And so from there, you get an opportunity to go back to Wittenberg, correct?
Yes, that's right, Mike. At the end of that year, Bob Hamilton, my college coach, got the Navy job, United States Naval Academy, head coach. And Larry Hunter, who was had been the assistant coach, I think, for my senior year, and then 2 more years after that, the 2 years I was out, he was the assistant coach to Bob Hamilton. And when Bob got the job at Navy, Larry became the head coach. And then Larry gave me my chance to get into college coaching and brought me back to Wittenberg as his full-time assistant. And so that's how I got back there as assistant coach. And then I coached with Larry, I think, for 5 years. I was with him, and those were 5 great years. We had some outstanding players. And we won the national championship in the first year back when Larry took over his first year as head coach, won the Division III National Championship. And the year before, when Bob was the head coach, they went to the National Championship game and lost to Scranton in the National Championship game. And a lot of those same players then returned, and Larry took over and won the national title in 1977. So that was a great experience. And then we had some other good teams, and before I left to become a head coach in Pennsylvania, that was a great experience. I learned a lot from Larry about coaching, of course. And unfortunately, Larry passed away just a couple years ago when he was coaching at Western Carolina. But Larry was just a tremendous man, tremendous coach, and he meant the world to me, and I'll forever be indebted and thankful to him for giving me the opportunity to coach with him.
What do you remember about that time in terms of what you learned about being a good assistant? And then we'll talk, after we talk about that, we can talk a little bit about what the transition was like to go from being a college assistant to being a college head coach. But talk a little bit about what you learned from Coach Hunter about being a good assistant coach, or what it took to be a good assistant coach.
Well, of course, he was just a great teacher, and you know, spent a lot of time talking with me about, you know, how to coach the game. And of course, I had been around him when he was assistant, and Coach Hamilton when he was a head coach. So I was coached by two outstanding men there. So I learned a lot about fundamentals of the game. And so, of course, just being around him then as when he was a head coach and how he worked with the players and communicated with them, I learned a lot about that for sure. But I just learned that I needed to be loyal and work hard. Those are the main things that I think an assistant coach needs to do. Be a good teacher, but be loyal and work hard.
All right. In your mind, I think loyal is a word that almost universally, if you talk to somebody who has been either a head coach or an assistant, that's almost always a characteristic that is talked about. So just in your mind, and you can approach this either from the assistant's point of view or from the head coach point of view, what does loyalty look like when you're talking about an assistant coach?
Well, number one, you got to back the head coach up in every single way. You may not agree with everything, but once a decision's been made, you have to go along with what the coach has decided. And it was easy in my case with Larry Hunter because I loved him so much and believed in him that, you know, whatever he said, how I was going to sell. So I never had to go against anything that he ever said. And I've been fortunate with Coach Klein. You know, he loves Worcester and loved our program. So we had loyalty there. So, you know, you just have to put the program ahead of anything else. And that's number one, I think. What the team's going to accomplish should be your number one objective. Anything else, and that goes for players too. Being unselfish and putting the team ahead of the individual desires and wants, that's more important than anything in a team sport. And basketball is the ultimate team sport, Mike, as I know you'll agree with me on that.
Head Start Basketball, along with members of the J. Billis Skills Camp staff, will be hosting the very first Prime Skills Camp, an affiliate of the J. Billis Skills Camp that is held annually in Charlotte, North Carolina. Prime Skills Camp will take place on the campus of Western Reserve Academy, just outside of Cleveland, Ohio, June 26th through the 28th. And will be designed for boys rising to grades 6 through 9. Prime Skills Camp will mirror the J. Billis Skills Camp in daily programming, teaching, coach-to-camper ratio, and quality of instruction. Prime Skills Camp brings all of the team-oriented individual instruction, focus on the fundamentals, and high-level coaching to young men aspiring to a high school varsity basketball experience. This camp is operated by Billis Camp veterans and includes the J. Billis Coaches Development Program alongside the camp, ensuring that the quality of teaching and coaching at this camp is second to none. Please visit headstartbasketball.com or jbilliscamp.com for more information or to get registered.
Your basketball, because everybody everybody can do, can quote, do everything. You don't have, even though we have positions in basketball, it's not like the difference between an offensive tackle and a wide receiver in football, or the difference between a pitcher and a center fielder in baseball. In basketball, you definitely have to be able to, I think, as a coach, communicate players' roles to them and then get those players to buy into the role so that that five-man unit can have success. And if you can't get your team to buy into their roles and get everybody working together on the same page, as I'm sure you know well, things can go south very, very fast if people have their own personal agendas, as opposed to, as you said, making sure that what their number one goal is to help the team be successful. And that's, I think, somebody who's had success as a coach, I think if you can point to anything, that's probably what most coaches would attribute it to, is your ability to get players to buy into the team concept. And coaches that do that tend to have a tremendous amount of success.
Oh boy, that's for sure, Mike. You know, every player has to sacrifice something one way or another. It's different for each player, player to player. You know, some guys have to sacrifice and not be a starter. They worked all summer long, they wanted to be a starter, but it's for the best of the team that they're not a starter. Some guys get to start, but they might not get to shoot as much as they'd like to, or score as many points as they'd like to. So they have to sacrifice. And even the top scorer, he has to sacrifice some things one way or another. Maybe if he was on another team, he would average 20, but because we're going to be team-oriented, he's going to only average 15 or 14 maybe, and not maybe get some of the individual honors. But the team success comes first, so everybody has to sacrifice something. And that's really true in life, and that's how business can be successful, if everybody puts the team first.
All right, what's the – and I think this is probably too short of an answer that we'll have to dive into, but what's the secret to getting players to buy in and understand their role? How do you go about making sure that kids, A, understand what their role is, and then, B, how do you get them to accept that role when, as you said, everybody is sacrificing something? How do you get them to – want to sacrifice for the team? What are some things that you've had success with over the years in terms of doing that? Does it mostly come down to just communication?
Well, yeah, I think communication is huge, Mike. Let's be honest, though, a lot of it comes down to who you have in your program. In college, of course, we can recruit guys. In high school, the high school coaches, you know, they have to take who comes up and who's good enough to play for them. But you work on that in recruiting. You want unselfish players, so that's a part of it. But once you get them in the program, communication, you know, you have to emphasize what's important. But here's another big point: the older guys who have been through it must set the example. You must have that to have quality programs year after year after year if you want quality teams. You have to have guys who have been through it, who have learned how to sacrifice, who have learned how to put the team first, and they pass it down and show the example. And then those younger guys learn it, and they pass it down to the guys below them. And I think that's a big part of our success over the years at Worcester. We've had guys that taught the younger guys not only how to play in terms of fundamentals and teach them the game, but they teach them what's important and what will help us win, and that's being team first. So I think having good leadership, and that needs to be developed over the years, but it's got to start with having good people, and then they learn how to do that.
Yeah, I think there's two things that stood out for me about what you just said. One is the fact that if you have the right people and the right kind of people who you want to be part of your program, it makes it, I'm guessing, a lot easier to be able to get everybody going in the same direction. If you have the wrong people on your bus, so to speak, I'm guessing that it's a lot more difficult to get that bus to go where you want it to go. So I think the right people is definitely an important part of it. And then the second thing that I think you said was that you spent time, and I'm guessing you probably spent more time on this early in your time at Worcester, was building – building that leadership, teaching kids what it meant, what it means to be a leader when you're an upperclassman, and how you go about passing on the values and standards of your program to the younger kids. And then I'm guessing that that momentum sort of builds and builds and builds upon itself. And you got better at it as time went on, and the kids got better at it simply because you had done it year after year after year after year.
That's exactly right, Mike. People often ask me, you know, how have you had success year after year at Worcester? And I answer, well, number one, we have a lot of talent. We've had talented players, that's for sure. It's a great institution. It's a quality place. We have great facilities, so we can attract really talented guys. But it's also talented guys that work hard and quality people. And I was very fortunate when I first arrived that we had a couple guys, even though the program had been down a little bit, that there were some quality men in the program and excellent leaders that set the example. And then we brought in a very good class first year, which, as you remember, that was the year my first recruiting class was your senior year. And you might remember a guy named Eric Reby.
Absolutely.
Who was a great friend of Mark Albert's. And Mark and Eric were seniors there in the Wayne County, and Mark at Worcester High and Eric at Wayndale. And we were able to get Eric to attend Worcester, and that was our first recruit. In fact, my first day on the job, Al Van Wee was the legendary coach and athletic director. He was the athletic director at that time. And he said, your first thing you do on your first day of the job is to call Eric Reby. And I did, and we were lucky to get him. And he was a talent, but he also was a dedicated basketball player. And that was a big key to establish some success at Worcester, was having guys like that early on. Another guy of his couple of teammates, Mark Stanley from Norway, and also a Wayne County guy, and Tim Sutherland. Those guys pass it on. Matt Heason was a sophomore when I came into Worcester, and he was there because of baseball primarily, but he was a great baseball player drafted by the Indians, and then also played basketball and was a great leader. So we had these quality people who passed it on, like you said, and then it just kind of snowballed, and then I just kind of sat back and let the players recruit each other, new guys each year, and Coach Klein did a great job, and I got a lot of credit when other people did a tremendous job.
There's nothing wrong with that. But I think that it's interesting just to hear you talk about just the process of getting the whole thing started. And I think it still comes back to what you said a couple minutes ago, is you get the right people in place and everything gets easier. Things that you want to do, things that are important to you, ways you want to go about instilling the standards and culture of your program all become easier when you have good people that are a part of what you're doing. And that goes from your coaching staff to your players. And obviously I remember Eric very well, because just like we talked about before we jumped on here, you know, playing against Mark Alberts in the summertime and played against Eric in the summertime as well. And just both of those guys, tremendous players. And Mark ended up at Akron and Eric ended up at Worcester and I ended up at Kent. And so we were all kind of, you know, again, similar, I would say similar type of players. Not the most super athletic guys if you start thinking about what a typical Division I player might look like. But all of us smart players, all of us players that could had a high basketball IQ and I think ultimately good people. And when you get those kinds of people in your program, I think that's what leads you to the kind of success that you want to have. Let's think back to when you got your first opportunity to transition from an assistant coach and you get your first head coaching job at Muhlenberg College. Talk a little bit about what that transition was like for you to go from an assistant to a head coach.
Well, yes. And I left Wittenberg to go out of state to Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania, which, clear across Pennsylvania, almost to New Jersey. And I was an Ohio kid and hadn't been out of state that much myself. But I had not even heard of Muhlenberg College when they called me. But I was fortunate to get that job. And when I got there, I realized, man, this is a great place. It's a very nice college, great academics, very similar to Worcester. and the program had been down. So you know, we had to turn it around. And so the first thing was recruiting. And here I was in an area where, you know, I didn't know any coaches. It was Eastern Pennsylvania. And we had a lot of students were from New Jersey, which is right across the state line. And so we had to recruit guys from those areas. And so, number one, we just tried to get to know as many coaches as we could, see as many players as we could, and just tried to recruit numbers. And we got a lot of guys to come in. And that was a big thing because we really weren't sure who would be good players and who would not. We just kind of decided, well, let's just bring a lot of guys in. And fortunately, we had about four guys end up being really good players for us, quality men and quality players out of that big group. And we were able to turn it around. And the first year, we did not reach 500, but we won double the number of games that they won the first year. And in the second year, we had a winning record, and then we had some very successful years. But the transition was, a lot of people talk about that. You know, you move over 18 inches on the bench, but it's a big jump. It's not just inches. It's you got to make the decisions instead of make a suggestion. I just relied on what I learned from Bob Hamilton and Larry Hunter. I just relied on teaching the fundamentals of the game and being passionate and intense. And I think those things were what helped us have success, even though I made a lot of mistakes and I was learning with the players. But just emphasize the fundamentals, working hard, being passionate and intense, and those things have taken a long way, I think.
Absolutely. What was the biggest thing that, if you look back on that first experience, something that if you had it to do differently or if you would have set something up in a different way, what's something that you might have changed in that first iteration, something that you learned over the course of your head coaching career that when you look back at that first experience, you say, ooh, I wish I would have done this earlier and we might have gotten to a different point sooner?
Yeah, I probably, in player evaluation, first part of the year, I probably played some guys that later on in the year didn't play. And part of that was there were a couple of seniors who came around, played a couple of younger guys early. But these senior guys, they had been in a situation that was a losing program, but they really responded well to the coaching. And they ended up being much better than the guys that we played early on in the season. And I guess part of that was I should have realized it, but part of it was too, they really bought into the situation. And one guy who was really out of shape just lost a lot of weight, worked hard, got in shape. And another guy just changed his attitude and worked really, really hard. And those two guys ended up being our guards and did a good job for us. So I guess to answer your question, recognizing maybe right away, who was going to be the guys to get it done. And that's a big part of coaching is, evaluating your talent and recognizing. And when I was a young guy like that, I made some mistakes, I have to say.
Yeah, I think that's something that sometimes people from the outside, maybe who haven't been involved in coaching, don't always understand that evaluation piece. And I think that if you think about you think about parents who are clearly biased towards their own kids in most cases. But then you just think about the general fan, and we know that there's any given game that you go to, there's 500, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 other coaches that are sitting up in the stands, second guessing what you're doing and thinking about and offering their opinion about what it is that you're doing now on the floor. And I think that, it ultimately comes down to, as a coach, when you're talking about evaluating your talent and trying to put your best team on the floor, there are times where, again, do coaches make mistakes? Sure they do. And I think probably, as you stated, the less experience you have, I'm sure the more difficult that is. And I'm sure that as it goes along, you start to find and recognize, A, the characteristics that you look for in a player, and B, you just get better at finding and identifying the guys who are going to help you to win with the style of play that you want to play.
That's right, Mike. And another thing is, I think as time went along, I learned that, you know, you motivate guys in different ways. Some guys you can really get intense with, some guys you can't be as intense. And I think that was another thing I learned as time went along. You have to realize the player and how to motivate him and what he reacts to, what he'll respond to. I think that's something that the coaches get better at as time goes along.
How long, when a kid first comes into the program, how long does it take you to get to know that kid? And I'm sure it varies, obviously, person to person, but just in general, how long does it take you as a coach to be able to get an understanding of how that kid best can be coached and what they react to best in terms of your style of interacting with them, your way of coaching them? How long does that process typically take?
Well, as you said, it can be different with different guys, but some guys you find out right away, other guys, you know, they'll fool you a little bit, and so it takes a little while. Maybe you get into the season and play some games before you know for sure. But it's a process, Mike, and you know, Coach Klein's great at that, and I relied on him heavily over the years, and you know, how different guys would receive coaching, and he's been good at that ever since he's a young coach. So yeah, he's going to continue to do a great job. There's no doubt about it.
All right. So let's talk about how the opportunity comes for you to leave Muhlenberg and go to Worcester. It sounds like the situation at Muhlenberg was a pretty good one. So what prompted your decision to go and leave and go to Worcester?
Well, Mike, it was a very good situation. You know, we had won a couple of titles in our division, in the Middle Atlantic Conference, and it was a great school. It really was top-notch academics, and we had some nice young men there that played hard for us. And but it was all about family. My wife's from the same hometown, Monroeville. At that time, when we left Muhlenberg, we have two daughters. They were 6 and 4 years old, and at that time, all their grandparents were alive, and their cousins were there in Monroeville. And so we wanted to be closer to family. And Worcester was an hour away from the hometown. And when that opportunity came to apply, that was almost a perfect situation. And so while it was very tough to leave Muhlenberg, some of those players are still very close to me. And I love those guys, and it was tough to leave. But it was all about family, and it worked out great because my daughter's grandparents were still alive for several years after we moved, and they were able to grow up and be around them. And you know, it was a great, great location. Not to mention, it turned out to be a great place to coach at also.
Absolutely. All right. Before we dive into the program, I want to ask you, I think this is a good point to ask this question. How did you, as a head college coach, how did you balance the needs of your family with the needs of the basketball program? Because I think that's something that coaches at all levels, you talk to them, and almost universally, I think there's that struggle. There's that push and pull of my family needs me at home, my players, my program needs me at school. How did you go about balancing or trying to keep both sides of that equation happy, so to speak?
Well, I have a tremendous wife who was a tremendous mother, and my wife Jane did a great job with the daughters, and it was tough though, you know, to go recruiting on a Tuesday night and a Friday night when, you know, they'd want you to stay home and watch a movie with them and have popcorn, and but you know, you had to get to those games because if you didn't, you know, you weren't going to get the recruits. I remember my daughter Beth holding on to my leg saying, "Daddy, don't leave. Don't go to recruit. I want you to stay home." It was so hard. But, you know, you just try it. Whenever you are home, you want it to be the best quality time you can make it. And, you know, you take them to the gym when you can, too, and they run around during practice. And the game, the program, the team became a huge part of their lives. My two daughters, Beth and Emily, I don't know if they would trade being a coach's daughter and being involved in the program all those years. In fact, they still just, you know, even to the last game, just were there and loved the program, the players, the team, and you just make your family part of the team and part of the program, and it works. And I remember going to when they were young, they played in the elementary school basketball games, and I would go even if we played a Saturday afternoon game at home, I would go and watch them play at 9 a.m. and maybe in those days you didn't do as much preparation because of it, and the last minute preparation, but you wanted to be at those games, and so I went to them and made it a priority.
I think being intentional about it is one of the things that comes through there. It's one of the things that I think a lot of coaches have mentioned, that it's really easy to lose sight of what's really important and get caught up in your season. And we all know how important our season becomes to us as coaches when we're in the midst of it. And I think it's important to be able to step back and be able to see that there is that bigger picture, and you do have a wife and daughters or family at home that need you as well. And I think striking that balance is always something that coaches found challenging in the past. And I think it's going to continue to be a challenge in the coaching profession as we move forward. And it's always good to hear stories of guys like yourself who were able to balance that out and be able to be both a great coach and have the tremendous success that you were able to have, and then also be able to have those family relationships stay intact. And, unfortunately we hear about so many coaches who get divorced and just don't have those quality family relationships that you were able to maintain throughout your entire career. And I think that that's something to be held up as an example of, that it can be done, and you just have to work really, really hard at it. And as you said, you got to have a supportive spouse at home in order to make that happen, for sure. And I think most coaches who stay married during the course of their coaching career would agree with you on that 100%, that you got to have somebody at home who's 100% in your corner.
Boy, that's for sure, isn't it, Mike? That's extremely important, no doubt about it.
All right, let's think about back when you first got there. And obviously Worcester had a tremendous tradition before you got there. But in your first year, when you first set foot on campus, do you remember back at that time, what were some of the things that you thought you had to do personally in order to be able to continue and build on the success that was already there?
Okay, I think it was number one, to establish discipline. The tradition had been there. Al Van Wee was the coach for many years. Mose Hole before him, great program. But it slipped for a little bit for 4 years there, I think, after Al was out of coaching. And a couple years before I came, they had losing records. And I think they lacked some discipline. And so, we came in and tried to establish that right away, by making sure everybody was on time. We're very strict about that. We established some workouts in the morning, just to make sure that, find out who really wanted it, who would really pay the price and sacrifice and come in early in the morning to do workouts. And so things like that, and just making sure guys were on time, making sure at practice that guys stayed on task, listened played team basketball, established discipline in terms of teamwork and togetherness. I think those intangibles, teaching the game was important too, but those intangibles in terms of discipline and doing things right, the right way, on time, had to be established. That those things had slipped up, I think. But then I think, too, teaching the game, going back to a very fundamental approach, I think that was a key thing right off the bat, was teaching the guys, working on passing, working on how to throw a correct bounce pass, how to jump stop, how to pivot. I think some of those things had slipped in that program before we came there, and so we became very fundamentally sound, very fundamentally oriented, I should say, and tried to be fundamentally sound, work on the fundamentals of all fundamentals of the game. And instead of just trying to get a lot of stuff in team-wise, we really tried to be fundamentally oriented. I think that was a big key, Mike.
Coaches, we've teamed up with Coach Tyler Whitcomb so you can now purchase his exclusive new playbooks right from the Hoopheads Pod website. If you're looking for ways to improve your team next season, these playbooks blend affordability with the quality content that serious coaches are looking for. Just visit hoopheadspod.com/store and you'll find playbooks from John Calipari of Kentucky, Leonard Hamilton from Florida State, and Mike Young of Virginia Tech. Check out these great resources at hoopheadspod.com/store.
So if you're developing and you think about, and this may have changed over the course of the time, obviously, that you were there, but when you think about putting together a practice plan, how much of the time would you say was focused on what somebody from the outside might call individual skill development fundamentals versus how much was focused on putting in team stuff, offensive and defensive team stuff and out of bounds plays and that kind of thing? How would you characterize the split in time between individual skill development and the development of your team?
Well, like I said, early on, the first year, we were really that way. And I don't think we changed that whole lot that way over the years. Even in the last year of coaching, we would be very fundamental in our teaching at the beginning of the year. And I think that's one of the reasons why our teams would always play later in the year, because we would work on fundamental things early, maybe not get team things in as much. By working on those fundamental things throughout the year, I think we would play better at the end of the year when the tournament time came. And so that's been our approach, and maintain that approach. But in terms of time, I think, you know, you got to work on the team things for sure. But we spend time with basics of the game early on in practice, working with individuals, working on individual skills throughout the year. So I'd say that you try to balance it up, individual work, teamwork, balance your defense and your offense too. You know, we've received a lot of notoriety over the years for people said we've been successful because of good defense, and that's been a part of it. But we emphasize offense just as much. And Coach Pine's a great offensive coach. In fact, the last many years, he was the offensive coach, and we kind of had offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator, and Coach Pine's been in charge of the offense. So, but I think you have to work hard at both ends of the court to be a championship team.
So at the beginning of your career, did you not have those roles as clearly defined for your assistants at the beginning as you did at the end?
That's correct, yeah. Mike Worrell was our full-time assistant in the early years. And as Mike coached with me, I just gained more and more confidence in him. And he was an outstanding coach and went on to be a head coach at Illinois College. And I was very fortunate to have him because he was also an excellent recruiter. So he was the full-time assistant until he left to go to Illinois College, and that's when Coach Fine took over. But then just having Coach Fine with me for so many years, from 1995 until the present, you know, that's a long time. So he just kept getting better and better as a coach, and it just evolved. He's really good at watching the pros and the major colleges and getting new ideas for offense. And adjusting our offense to the personnel, he's been great at that. And for example, in the right around 2005, 2006, we stopped having a lot of big post players that we could go inside with the ball, and so we had fast post, shorter, faster players on the post areas, and our guards were fast and good shooters. So we played much more up tempo, and Coach Klein was the reason for that. He did a great job recognizing that, and so we changed our based on our personnel, and I think that's an important thing in coaching.
Yeah, that's something that I think that is somewhat underrated when it comes to having long-term coaching success, because I think so often, and as coaches, we all have things that we like to do, whether that's things we like to do offensively, things we like to do defensively, and just either we like to teach them or we think that those are the most successful ways that we can play, or that maybe as players we like to play that way. But I think the best coaches are able to, as you said, take a look at your personnel and say, oh, you know, we used to be able to get these big burly guys inside and we could dump the ball in the post, and now we have quicker, faster guys, so we need to get up and down the floor more and open up our offense. And I think the best coaches take a look at what their personnel can do and then make adjustments. It sounds like that's what you guys have been able to do over the years, and I'm sure that's what's helped you to have the success that you had.
I think you have to adjust, Mike. And you know, in college, one might say, well, you can recruit the guys you need, and if you want to play a certain way, you can recruit this position, that position. But not having athletic scholarships, it's not as easy to get exactly who you want and you know, make your team up that way. Plus, too, Mike, we all know the game has changed so much here in recent years.
Absolutely.
You don't see guys that want to play in the post nearly as much. Everybody wants to be a guard, even your big guys. At our level, that's 6'6 and 6'7. They see Kevin Durant, 7-footer, these tall guys playing outside shooting threes, and that's what these younger guys want to do. You know, you have to adjust to the way the game's changing. It's become more guard-oriented, and kids grow up learning how to play with the dribble and come off ball screens. And so that's filtered down, and the college game has become ball screen, ball screen, ball screen, as opposed to, you know, more of the movement offense off the ball. And so you got to adjust to that. And once again, Coach Klein has been awesome with that. I would not have been doing as well as him if I was in charge of the offense. He's been great, and that's why he's going to continue to have a great program.
Yeah, it really is amazing how much the game has changed. I think there's three things that I find to be super interesting when I think back to my time as a player, and then I think about early years of coaching. And those three things are, one, I still don't think I'll ever be able to wrap my head around teams coming down on a 3-on-1 and shooting a three. I'll never be able to quite wrap my head around that one. So that's it. That's one. Number two, I think I played my entire basketball career without ever driving underneath the basket and kicking the ball all the way back out outside the three-point line up by the top of the key. Maybe to the baseline, but never back out to the top of the key. And then I think about the number of ball screens that I was involved in, whether defensively or offensively. And I'm sure that the number that I was involved in probably in my entire college career was the same as what a lot of your kids probably are seeing in one or two games at this point in basketball. It's just amazing how different the game has changed into from what it was like 20 or 30 years ago.
Boy, you're right, Mike. The offensive approach to offense, you know, in the early years, the way to get those good 3-point shots was to throw it inside and then kick it back out. Now it's to drive the ball, and if they collapse, kick it out. So yeah, you're right. That's a huge change, and that's what players like to do, and that's what players are good at. And the 3-point shot, of course, has changed the game a lot. Now this year, you know, the arc moved back, but not for Division II and III. So that'll be an adjustment for our guys. I'll be interested to see how the stats came out with this year. Did the percentages go down in Division I with that greater distance for the 3-point shot? But that was delayed a year for small colleges because the administrators, I think, thought that, you know, small colleges might not be able to repaint their floor. So they gave them 2 years. So now all college basketball will be the longer arc, the international distance, the 22-foot plus, as opposed to 20-foot 9 inches. So that some people might not realize that in Division II and III, we played with the 20-foot 9 this year, and we'll make the change for next year.
Yeah, you'd have to think that at least initially in the first year or two until teams and players get adjusted to that, you would have to think there would be, you know, the percentages would have to go lower at least for a year or two until people kind of catch up. And then just, yep. There's so much good shooting in the game today. Again, again, compared to you compare it to 20 years ago, where you might have had two or three guys who could shoot it from out there with a kind of consistent basis. And now you just have so many more kids that can stand outside that line and knock shots down compared to what it was like in the past, for sure.
I agree. And players will adjust. And right now we have some guys with the range that shoot it, you know, further out, but some guys will have to work and improve their range. But isn't it amazing, though, that the NBA 23-9, how those guys make those shots at that distance?
Oh, it's incredible. The shooting today is just it's unbelievable, honestly, at all levels. When you look at, I think just from a sheer, like I said, to me, it's more about the, yeah, there are some guys who are just unbelievable. And clearly at the NBA level, there's guys that are fantastic, and even in the college level. But what I'm amazed by is the depth of guys, of players who can shoot the ball and who are more skilled. And I think this is a conversation I'd like to get your opinion on it. We've talked to some other coaches, and I think that if you look back again, let's say 15 or 20 years ago, I think that kids today, especially if you look at like a high school roster of basketball players, I would say players 9, 10, 11, 12 are far more skilled than the players 20 years ago. Now, I don't know if they're better basketball players, if they have a higher basketball IQ, but I know for sure that player 12 on a high school team today can do more things with the ball, can shoot the ball better than the 12th man 15 years ago. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's probably right, Mike. Yeah, I think so. And that comes from a guy who was a great shooter in your own right, right? I mean, you were a very good shooter.
Yeah, that was back a long time ago. But yeah, I could shoot a little bit, I guess.
That was a strength.
Mike does not like to talk. Mike does not like to talk about how he can shoot the basketball. He does not like to talk about it. I still see him shoot the ball well. By the way, I've seen him shoot the ball well. He won't admit it, but he does.
Once a shooter, always a shooter.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said for that. Although, to be honest, I wish I could still be the guy that could get up 300 shots in a day. I should probably be out of my driveway now while we're all quarantined, just getting shots up all the time. Probably should spend a lot more time out there. So, shooting is just, it's obviously a skill that is always going to be valuable no matter what. And I think in today's game, with the rules the way they are, it's more valuable at this point than it's ever been.
Yeah, and like you say, more guys shoot it. For example, 20 years ago, you only had two post up guys, the four spot, the power forward. That guy was around the basket. Now he's a shooter, right? They call it stretch four, and now everybody wants to be a stretch five. Your five man wants to shoot the ball, the center. So, that makes it hard to guard when you have that many guys who can shoot the three. So that's where basketball is going.
Absolutely. There's no question about that. All right. I wanted to ask you, obviously you were at Worcester for a long, long time with a tremendous amount of success. I'm sure at some point along the road that some other schools came calling, maybe some at a higher level. Just explain the thought process of staying at Worcester for as long as you did. What was special about Worcester? What did you love about the place? What made you want to stay there for the duration of your 30 some years?
I guess number one, the quality of the young men that I coached. Year after year, we get really good players, good enough to win for us. We're also quality people. And it's a pretty good situation to be in. And, I guess if I wanted to coach in major college, when I was young coach, I would have needed to go be an assistant. Now, some guys go from Division III head coach to Division I, but that doesn't happen very often. If you want to be in Division I, you need to, start out in Division I as an assistant, I think. I just decided that I would rather be in small college. That suited me better. I was better suited for that. It just worked out to stay at Worcester. It was a great situation, really great community. Great place for my daughters to grow up, and we had great support too, Mike. I think you probably know that our attendance at the games is outstanding for small college. We've been in the top five in Division III in nationally in attendance for years and years. So we get great support. Our fans love our team, and that's a fun situation to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fun to be able to play in a gym that's full of fans, where there's a lot of excitement, and being able to coach or play in that environment. There's nothing better in a game of basketball than being able to play and coach in front of a packed house night after night. And then obviously with the success that you were able to have, that leads more and more people to want to be supportive of your program and come out and watch you play. I want to ask one final question here, Steve, before we wrap up. And that is, if you look back on the totality of your career and a young coach came to you looking for advice. So a 22, 23 year old coach comes to you and says, "Coach, I want to be able to have a long, successful career in the coaching profession." It doesn't necessarily have to be at the college level or the high school level, but if you had one or two pieces of advice for a young coach, what would you say to that young person who came and asked you for advice?
Well, I think I would tell them to work at establishing good relationships. Sure, you want to win basketball games, and we've been fortunate to win games and championships, but establish relationships with your players, with your other staff members, because that really is, in the long run, the most important thing. And winning games was fun, that's for sure. But the long-lasting things that, for me, are the relationships that I have and will continue to have with our players. They're lifelong friends. They mean so much to you. So establish those relationships by really getting to know your guys and really work hard at trying to make an impression and influence on them outside, off the court as well as on the court. Pay attention to their academics, pay attention to their lives in general, and really try to influence them as people as well as players.
Man, I think that's a great piece of advice, Steve. I think if every coach at every level who gets involved in the coaching profession, and again, that goes across all sports, not just basketball, but you think about having an impact on the kids that you are in contact with, both as players of their sport, but then more importantly, having that influence on them as people. So you end up producing not just good basketball players, but you end up producing good citizens. To me, that's really what coaching is all about. And obviously, the more success you have, one loss, the more of an opportunity that gives you to be able to have a greater impact on the kids that become part of your program. And so, as I said when we started right off the top, Steve, I'm honored that you would take the time out of your schedule to come on and talk to us here on the Hoopheads podcast. Before we finish up, I want to give you a chance to share how people can find out more about you or more about the Wooster basketball program. And then if there's anything else that we didn't touch on tonight, any final words of wisdom you want to leave us with, you can do that. And then I'll jump back on and wrap up the episode.
Okay. Well, Wooster basketball will continue to go on. And as I mentioned several times, Coach Doug Klein's in charge now. Contact him. The program's going to be successful with him as the head coach. And he'll do a great job. And it's a great institution. The thing about the College of Worcester is there's excellence in both areas. We've had a good basketball program, but I'll tell you what, the academics are outstanding. And we have great professors who are very concerned about their students. And it's a great education as well as getting a chance to play in a winning program. So I'll sell Coach Klein because he promoted our program for years and told players to go to Worcester. I'm going to keep helping him do that. That's for sure.
That's fantastic. I think that it sounds like from everything that you've said tonight and from what we know about the success of the program under your guidance, I'm sure Coach Klein is going to continue the success over the next several years and however long he's going to continue to be there. So, Steve, again, we can't thank you enough for joining us on the Hoopheads podcast tonight. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Registration is now open at headstartbasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps. We'll be hosting camps for boys and girls in grades 1 through 6 throughout the greater Cleveland area. Get registered today and make sure you hit the courts with us this summer.
Hey everyone, last year at the Junior NBA Summit, I came across an amazing company called iSport 360 and its founder, Ian Goldberg. Their youth sports app gets coaches, players, and parents on the same page.
your team can set goals, share player feedback, training videos, sticker rewards, player evals, and practice assignments. All of this to foster a healthy team communication and culture. If your team or club struggles to keep open lines of communication, especially among team parents, iSport 360 can help. If you want to empower your athletes to have more success, more confidence, and more communication with their teammates, give iSport 360 a try today. Shoot me an email, mike@hoopheadspod.com, or give me a call at 216-392-4059 to learn more.
Being without basketball right now is tough for all of us, so we've partnered with Pro Skills Basketball to offer you a 50% discount on their Ultimate Shooting Guide and Video Program that will put players on a guided path to becoming the best shooter they can be. With 1 year's worth of workouts that includes games, drills, and competitions, players will gain access to a blueprint showing them what it takes to become an elite-level shooter. If you're looking to improve your shooting at home, this program can help. Visit hoopheadspod.com/store to check it out.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.